Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview with Howard Millman, who, for much of his career, has been saving theaters from bankruptcy, from disaster, from catastrophe, while all the time yearning to do what his love is, what his passion is, and that is to direct. He has gotten the opportunity while saving this or that theater to direct, but now, in his retirement, he gets to do what he loves to do and to, as you will hear him say, choose his projects. His current project is the extraordinary production of The Whipping Man, currently playing at West Coast Black Theater Troupe. And so this is Howard's story and also the story of how WBTT came to do The Whipping Man and how Howard got to direct it. It's a lovely story. Hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
It's ironic, but so many of us actually aren't who we really are. We are some version of it, some part of who we're demonstrating, who we believe ourselves to be, is actually truly who we are. But it is my belief that most of us are keeping some of, maybe much of, who we really are, what I call undercover. The person that we demonstrate, the person that we believe we are, that in my view is a cover story. As I've said before, it's like the cover story that a spy uses, and for the same reason. A spy uses a cover story that is some version of him or herself that's not the truth, because to allow who he or she really is to be known would be dangerous. And this is the same reason that we do it. Only we don't do it in a foreign country. We do it right in our own backyard, so to speak. It is the family of origin, generally, that encourages us to hide qualities of ourselves, or should I say, discourages us from presenting, demonstrating, showing, and therefore knowing who we really are. But even if we get a lot of support from our family of origin, there is still our school. And the experiences lots of kids have in school, either from teachers who are not really equipped to teach, or from peers who bully, or simply because they are not like what everybody else is. They're taller or shorter, or they have the wrong color hair or eyes or skin, or, and I've used this example a lot, they have a laugh that other people think is funny. This kind of teasing, this kind of judgment is equally debilitating, discourages us from being who we really are. But even if we manage to have an encouraging family of origin and a fairly non-threatening school experience, there is still religion and the culture. Some of us grow up in a culture that says that something that is natural to us is actually ugly or dangerous or evil. And of course, we believe it. We believe whatever the major influences on us tells us about ourselves. And if you have experienced some of this in your childhood, your family of origin thought that your interest in dance was, you were a little boy and you liked to dance, and your father thought that was sissy, or you were a little girl and you wanted to take trucks apart and your mother thought that was not feminine, or your school did not understand that you had a learning disability and thought that you were deficient. And listen to Sonia Sotomayor's autobiography, and she talks about this at length, about the fact that kids who started school but didn't really know English were often thought to be defective and were put in defective classes, when there was nothing wrong with them except that nobody was teaching them to speak the language that everybody else was speaking. So there are so many ways that we can be made to think that something about us is not good. And the ironic thing about us is that children have the most remarkable capacity to first pretend that that is not happening, they are not that, and then to completely forget that they ever were that. I hear a lot from people who can't get in touch with one or another emotion. They can't get angry, or they can't cry, or they can't be joyful. And they can't do that because, in some cases, it's because a parent told them that was bad or wrong, but in other cases, it's because if they were sad or hurt, they saw that this was really difficult for one or another of their parents, and in an attempt to protect the parent from that, they denied those feelings. So, I mean, there are so many ways in which we can't come out of childhood whole. So, if one has been encouraged to pretend that something about them is not there, not true. And so you've come into adulthood believing that you just can't get angry, or you just can't cry, or this thing of putting your hand over your mouth whenever you laugh or smile or giggle, you can't stop your hand from going there, you don't know why you do that. Or, you know, you can't dance no matter what, no matter what your husband or wife asks you to do, you get up on the floor and you feel shame, and so you don't do it. You know, I'm describing all the things that, some of the many things that we can be forced to deny. And why is this important? Well, partly it's important because when you've denied something, although it hasn't gone away, it's still there. And so you know there's something wrong with you. You know that you suspect. You can feel the out of syncness about yourself, and that doesn't feel good. Also, it takes energy to suppress a part of ourselves, and that energy is stolen from the things you might do in your life. But even if all of that weren't true, you're cheated from the life that you could have led, from the joy you might have had, from the career you might have pursued, from the self-regard, the self-esteem that is rightfully yours. And so the Lynn Show is about making the point that this can happen, does happen to many of us. Sometimes I think it happens to all of us. Nobody gets out of childhood whole. But that it is not, but that it is possible to recover these things which we have lost. It's not as simple as I said it and you think, oh, yes, you know, I find that it's hard for me to break into spontaneous laughter and I'd really like to, and oh, yeah, right, well, I will now. No. The taboos that got you not to do it in the first place are still there, and you have a fail-safe going on inside of you that stops you from doing it. And that, of course, is what psychotherapy, one of the things psychotherapy is good at fixing. And as a psychotherapist, I know that. So if you suspect that you have denied something and you are curious about the possibility of recovering it and you want to talk to me about that, you can do that by going up on my website, thelynshow.com. thelynshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. thelynshow.com, and click on email me and say you're curious to talk about this and I'll get back in touch with you. There's also an article on the website called Psychotherapy on the Go, which explains how psychotherapy on the phone works, which is how I do it these days. And also, there's a copy of my book, which talks about this at length, if you want to get that, or even just listen to the first chapter, which is up there in audio. Also up on my website are all of the shows I have ever done, including all of the interviews that I have ever aired in any of my shows, including the one I'm about to air for you now, which is with Howard Millman, the savior of any number of theatrical organizations. Howard has a very, very interesting, varied, unusual background. And as you will hear him say, his attachment to theater is all about love, his passion, his desire, his love to be involved in the theater and mostly to direct for the theater, which he's been fortunate enough to do, although perhaps not as much as he might have wanted. And now in his retirement at 82, he gets to direct what he wants to. And one of the things he passionately wanted to direct was The Whipping Man, which he has done for the West Coast Black Theater Troupe. And The Whipping Man is running now. I think they might extend it. It's been sold out. If you're near Sarasota, call up, see if you can get on the waiting list, because it's an extraordinary play with extraordinary actors, extraordinarily well directed. Clearly a labor of love for everyone involved in it. So I'm going to play Howard's interview now, in which he will talk about how he became the guy he is and what he did in his life, and also he will talk at length about The Whipping Man. So here is Howard Millman. So I'm here with Howard Millman in the offices of West Coast Black Theater Troupe. Do you remember the very first time acting, stories, performances, any of that attracted you, called you, that you were aware of them?
Very clearly. Well, let's see, I have to go back to my childhood because I was always in love with the movies and plays and things like that, having grown up in New York.
So you started going to movies and plays when you were...
Well, when I was, as a kid, I was 8 or 9, and I would go with my friends, you know, Saturday afternoon and see all the Saturday afternoon movies and what have you. In fact, I had to trade in 2 milk bottles and a soda bottle to get the 11 cents to get into our local movie. and then, you know, I started, as I got older, I started, the first play I ever saw on Broadway.
Yeah?
Was A Class Trip.
What year?
I guess I was in about the fifth grade. And so the first play that I experienced was Othello with Paul Robeson and Jose Ferrer and Uta Hagen.
You're kidding.
No.
Talk about starting at the top.
Starting right at the top. And I just went crazy. I fell in love with it.
Well, wait a minute. This is kind of an unusual play to take fifth graders to, isn't it?
I know, but that's what they did in New York in those days. You know, they just, you know, absolutely.
Amazing.
Oh, yeah. And I remember it very clearly. And, you know, I secretly always wanted to do this kind of work. But as my father said to me when I mentioned to him, I guess when I was 15 or 16, I wanted to be an actor. And my father, being an Eastern European Jew, immigrant, said, an actor? What kind of shingle can you hang outside your door? Can you hang out a shingle there? You can hang out a shingle that says doctor or lawyer or CPA, but how do you hang a shingle out of your door that says actor on it?
Right.
So, I think all of that drew me, you know. I mean, my grandmother took me to the Yiddish theater and I saw some of the great stars of the Yiddish theater.
Wow.
I barely understood the language, but I got enough out of it so that I could get it, you know. Yeah, it was that kind of thing. My life as an artist has taken a lot of strange turns. I mean, I'm of a generation that, you know, when you went into the theater, you didn't do what they do today. Actors, for instance, and directors take advanced degrees with professional programs in universities such as the Oslo has. In my day, we didn't do that. I mean, I do have a master's and I have all the work for my PhD. I have a PhD called ABD, you know, all but dissertation. And but I did all of that. But the intention was never really to get those degrees to then go into professional acting or directing. In those days, you got those degrees so that...
You could teach if you had to.
Teach if you could back it up.
Yeah, right.
When I was a freshman at a very small school in upstate New York, Lutheran school, what this nice Jewish boy was doing in Lutheran school, I have no idea. I thought, when I went to school, I thought, okay, the closest thing that I can attach myself to in terms of performance is I'll be a lawyer. I had no idea that lawyers did most of their work in their offices. I thought a lawyer would be Perry Mason, you know, in the courtroom.
Right.
And I knew I spoke pretty well, even though I spoke at that time with a very heavy Brooklyn accent. But I had a note in my box. I was 17 years old. I had a note in my box that said, I have a role for you in Goethe's Faust. Will you please come and see me? Signed by the director of the play, Dr. Lohan.
How did he know you?
It's a small school, and I had speech classes, and I did, you know, that kind of thing.
Yes.
Yeah, get this guy. They were probably scraping the barrel, you know, at that point.
Well, they were looking for somebody who looked like they could do it, right?
Trying to find the last of a cast of thousands, you know. And it was a nice little role. And after about 2 weeks of rehearsal, he called me over. And he said, Mr. Millman, he said, you are rough and you need training, but you are an actor.
Oh, my.
And I changed my major the next day and then told my parents, it's okay, I'm going to teach.
Ah, yes, of course.
That's how I got away with it.
Of course.
And that's what's done. I never looked back. 17, I never looked back.
This is really interesting to me. This guy told you what you were.
He confirmed. All I needed was somebody to confirm my own feelings about
it,
you know.
Right.
And he confirmed that I could do this.
So luckily for you.
Yes.
I mean, really, this is a sort of, I don't know, deus ex machina, no?
In
I mean,
some
the guy
way, yes.
comes down
the
and
The machine
says,
came down and said, that's it.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I have a younger sister. She's 6 years younger than I.
So you're the oldest boy in a Jewish family?
I am the oldest boy in a Jewish family. I'm the prince.
You're the prince.
You know,
yes,
I'm the prince.
I know you are.
Yeah.
But still, shouldn't you be a dentist or something?
My father didn't understand what it meant for me to go on to advanced degrees. He had no idea of that. He thought you go to college, you get out, and you go to work.
Are you first generation?
I'm definitely first generation.
Where did they come from?
Russia.
Ah.
Yeah, my father was 10 years old when he came here. My mother was 2 years old. She kept telling us she was 2 months old, but we found out after she died that she was 2 years old when she came here. She always lied to her age a couple of years. And all of my grandparents were alive, so I had all of the richness of that upbringing, you know, which I ran away from for so many years and then came pouring back to because it was so wonderful and rich and full and colorful. At any rate, I got out of undergraduate school and went to graduate school at Purdue University to take my master's. And then I got married right away.
Young.
Very young. You did that in those days.
Yeah.
I was 22 years old when I got married.
Yeah.
And 5 years later, I had a child. But in the meantime, I went into the Army.
Mm.
And
when was that?
This was in 1953. I went into the Army.
Korea?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Did you fight?
Oh, I defended your nation's capital for 2 years.
Well, we're so grateful. Oh, you did such a good job.
I was in an anti-aircraft battalion that ringed Washington, D.C. in case the Russians came over.
Oh, my God.
And at any rate, when I was in training, in my second 8 weeks of basic training, we all expected to be sent to the second 8 weeks of infantry training and then to go over to Korea. But they go through the process of interviewing you. And they interviewed me and they said, well, where do you want to go for your second 8 weeks? And I said, well, considering my background, I want to go to the Army Film School in Governor's Island, New York. And he said, you got to enlist for that. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. So he said, well, give me another choice. And I said, quartermaster school. I had no idea what quartermaster was.
But you figured it wasn't infantry.
It wasn't infantry, that's all. And I didn't expect to go. And the next thing I knew, I was assigned to Fort Lee, Virginia. I arrived on a weekend and wandered over to Special Services Office at Fort Lee before I started my training. Walked in the door when the corporal turned to the sergeant and said, who are we going to get to direct the big musical on post?
You're kidding. It's like a scene out of a movie.
Like a movie. It's like a movie. And I said, raise my hand. I said, here I am. And he said, who are you? And I told him. And, you know, how many directors with master's degrees walk through the door?
Yeah.
So he said, okay, but it was like community theater. You know, you finish your training, and then you worked until 2 o'clock in the morning doing the play.
Oh.
So I would get an average of maybe 4 hours sleep a night, nothing more. I would fall asleep in class. Mm. I learned nothing about the quartermaster, but I had a great show.
And that's important.
I had a great show. And then was assigned to Washington, D.C., and while I was at Washington, D.C., I directed for a group called the Pentagon Players. And then I got out and taught high school for a couple of years. Oh, I actually did more than teach high school. I got out in mid-year. I got out in January, and my wife was then teaching. And so I got a job teaching English and history in a junior high school. And, you know, then I said, ah, let's do a play. So I did Annie Get Your Gun. In those days, none of the schools ever did musicals. I mean, they was considered much too advanced for it. Today, the high schools all do them.
Right.
I did Annie Get Your Gun, and the people at the school, the superintendent's office, saw it. And so for the next 2 years, I had a job called dramatic consultant for Prince George's County, Maryland. I just went around and directed plays at the school.
Oh, my God.
I had a great time. Yeah. I had a great time.
Forgive me, but you seem to have a guardian angel.
Somewhere.
Yes, you seem to be...
Somewhere, you know.
Right, you're under the right star somehow.
That's right. And then I went to Florida State University in 1958 to take my doctorate at the urging of Dick Fallon, who had been my teacher in undergraduate school and who was my mentor. And he said, I've just gotten this job at Florida State University. Why don't you come and take your doctorate, which I did. And in 1959, we did a production of Clifford Odets' play, The Country Girl. I was in it, and Issa Thomas, who's one of the great actresses in this community for years and years and years, and Eb Thomas were in it. And we brought it to the Oslo Theater
The old one.
This is in the spring of 1959 for what they call the Art Symposium Week. And at that point, they decided to, the Department of Theater, the Department of Speech it was in those days, decided to do a summer season with graduate students in that space in 1960. And that year, my mother passed away. She was very young. And I thought I was needed back home, which I wasn't. And so I didn't join them. But I got an interesting job after a year of teaching. I got an interesting job with the United States Army in Europe as what they call a civilian entertainment director, doing plays for the soldier and by the soldier. And it was there that I really discovered my managerial skills, because the Army didn't care about the quality of the work that you did. They just wanted to know that it ran well. Mm-hmm. And I like to run things. And then in 1961, we were in Germany for 3 years, and I wound up the assistant command director for all of Europe in 3 years, which is, I was 29 years old or something like that. It's ridiculous. And then I was asked to come back to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to take over a singing program, which I did, and kind of built that up. And then Dick Fallon, they had then started the theater on a year-round basis in 1966. In 1968, he asked me to come and be the managing director at the Oslo Theater. And I said, I will, under one condition, that I direct plays, because managing directors don't direct,
they manage money.
They manage money. Okay, so I did that. And I directed, from 1968 to 1980, I directed 14 plays in that old Oslo Theater.
Wow.
And the problem was that nationally, the regional theater movement was just beginning to grow. And the problem was that I was very, very well known among my peers as a hot manager. And I didn't want to be a hot manager.
Yeah.
You know, I had 14 years of artistic work behind me, and I knew I had to leave to do that. To make a long story short, I wound up after a year and a half at the Pittsburgh Public Theater, which didn't work out for me. I wound up taking over a storefront theater in Rochester, New York in 1982. Called Jiva Theater, Genesee Valley Arts Foundation. I knew that when I took it over that they were losing their home, which was not much of a home. It was a storefront of about 160, 200 seats. And that was 1982. And by March of 1985, I opened a brand new 500-seat theater with 10,000 subscribers. So you can see from taking over the Oslo the first time when we were $250,000 in debt in 1968, and then going to Jiva and building that up, the kind of course my career took, which was building and saving theater. Those challenges were hugely exciting to me. And I was fearless. I was always fearless with other people's money, never with my own. And then in 1995, after having been at Jiva for 14 years, the Oslo got into serious, serious trouble. And Brad Wallace, who had been an actor with the company for years and years and years, 38 years with the company, called me and said, would you come back? And I said, well, in the proper conditions, I would come back. And he said, well, what are those? And I laid it out, you know, I wanted full charge, and I wanted to be back on the university payroll. And so I sent my resume to him. Interesting story. He took it to Carolyn. She was on the board.
Wow.
Now, we knew each other, but we knew each other as professional colleagues. You know, I knew who she was. I knew her parents, even though they were gone, I knew her parents very well because they were major supporters of the theater back in the 60s and the 70s. And so she took it around because I was gone for 15 years. So many people in town knew who I was, and so many board members did not know who I was.
Right.
And she said, this is the guy you want to hire. And they went through, I guess, 150 names and wound up with me.
So she got herself a husband.
She got herself a husband. Yeah, exactly.
Very smart.
Exactly. You know, and actually, it wasn't that simple.
No, it never is.
No, it wasn't.
No, it never is.
It wasn't. And that's how I came back in 95, when we were $2 million in debt and closing our doors and all of that. And
you did it again.
Well, it was, you know, I knew if I had enough time, it would be okay. The question was time. But I had an alternative plan. See, I knew that I was going to retire in Sarasota.
Very clever of you.
I knew that.
Mm-hmm. So you worked your way back, kind of.
So I thought, if it goes, I'm here.
That's right. And if it doesn't, you're here.
If it doesn't, I'm here. Either way.
Yeah.
So 11 or 12 years later, I finally retired.
And here you are.
And here I am.
But I know you're not retired.
I am retired from running a company. I will never do that again.
Yeah.
I never realized. I loved every moment. All my career, I loved every moment of what I did. But the day I retired, we took a month-long cruise, and I came back. And I realized when I came back and we walked through these doors and I got up the next morning that every day had been stress.
Yes.
Every day.
Yeah.
And suddenly...
Free.
You know.
Free at last.
All I became was the honeydew man, and that was good. But I am, you know, freelance directing, and have been doing that steadily for years, and enjoying it, and mm-hmm. continue to do it. And we travel in the summertime, and, you know, life is good. I don't think I can totally retire from doing what I love, which is directing plays.
Yeah.
I
you don't have to.
No.
It seemed like the universe sort of opened up for you, and things, you showed up, and...
That's right.
Yeah. Have you always been aware of that? Have you, you know...
Yeah. And I don't know if it's the opportunity being there and my being able to take advantage of it.
Yes.
You know.
Yes, that you always said yes.
I always had the confidence to know that I could do it.
Yes.
You know. It's really very strange. Even now, I mean, I'm directing a play and I'm 82 years old. And every time I've walked into a play, the first day, and this has been going on for 60 years, it's like a painter facing a blank canvas. I sit down at that table for the first read, and just before we start, I say, today they're going to find me out.
Really?
Yes. And then it goes away in an instant, as soon as they start to read. And then all of a sudden, it all just starts to bubble.
But what a paradox.
Yes.
On the one hand, we have this guy who's always confident
he can do it, and on the other hand,
we have this, they're going to find me out.
Right.
What a balancing act it must have been for you to keep that going.
It just disappears after about 10 minutes.
Because you can do it.
Because I realize I can, and what I realized this time, and I so loved this play, and I so loved rehearsing it with a wonderful cast.
We should say, because I didn't say already, that what you're doing currently is having directed The Whipping Man at the West Coast Black Theatre Troupe, which is running now.
I think the thing about this experience for me was not only did I still know how to do it, but I still could do it.
Yes.
And I'd be up out of my seat pacing the rehearsal hall with them and dealing with it with all of the energy of 30 years ago, you know.
Yes. So you couldn't know before you did it that would happen.
No.
But you said yes anyway.
I did.
Yes.
I did because I loved the play.
So I'm just curious, what have you been doing have you been directing?
I have directed my wife Carolyn. I've done maybe one a year. The interesting thing about it all is that the Directors Union came up with a new dues category this year.
You're kidding.
No. And it said, those of you who are not working anymore and still want to belong to the union can have emeritus status, and I think the fee was half what the normal fee is. And I wasn't thinking about directing again, you know. And so I sent in the emeritus status. Then I wound up doing Family Secrets with her in Rochester, and then Whipping Man, I got an email from them. Mr. Mullen, we noticed that you've been working.
and you don't qualify for emeritus status anymore.
I said, just send me a bill. We'll take care of it.
That's very funny.
And I also said, I said in my note, I just didn't realize at this age that those kinds of things would be presented to me. And I apologize for taking the emeritus status. She came back with, how wonderful that you could do this.
Exactly.
It was lovely.
Exactly.
It was
really lovely. It's lovely. It's lovely. Okay, so how did this thing evolve? How did this happen?
This play?
Yeah.
I knew about this play. Mm-hmm. And got the script from my friend B.J. Jones at the Northlight Theater in Chicago and emailed it to Nate. And I said, take a look at this. Mm-hmm. And he did. and he loved it, and he put it into the season. I didn't ask to direct it at that point. I wasn't thinking about that, but the play kept annoying me, so I loved it. We were at a WBTT fundraiser, and Eva Slain was standing with me, and Christine was standing over there. And you know Eva used to be a Broadway agent.
Oh, yes, I know.
Yeah. And I said to Chris, has Nate found a director for this play? And Chris said, well, I don't know. And Eva said, listen to the question.
She's so smart.
And Chris said, oh. And the next thing I knew, the next day Nate called me and I said, I'd like to do it, so.
Tell us about the play.
The play takes place the day Lincoln was shot, April 14th, 1865, in Richmond, Virginia. And a young Confederate captain comes home, the war has just ended, he comes home wounded. And the house is bombed out. And the only people left are an older former slave and a younger former slave, both of that household. Now, you not only have the dynamic of this captain who has fought at Petersburg for all those months and years, coming home to his home, but then having to deal with the fact that these guys are free. That's number one. Number two, they're all Jewish.
Fascinating. Is that historically accurate? It must be.
1.2% of the Jews in the South had slaves. This is not a true story, but it could have been.
Right.
1.2% of the Jews had slaves. And people, I mean, we had a talk back at the theater last night, and somebody said, well, how did they become Jewish? I said, wait a minute. All the Africans that came over here were Muslim. They became Christian because they lived in Christian homes.
Right. So they became
Jews.
It's
so far out of your, right, you know, concept, right, that could not happen.
Wow.
You know. And handed down generationally. And then, so the older man decides that he is going to hold a Seder to celebrate the freedom of the Jews from Egypt and the freedom of the slaves from the South.
So amazing.
It is. And then from there on, the story unfolds and unpeels like an onion. I cannot tell you all the secrets in the play.
No.
Because there are so many, you can't believe it.
No, I know. I saw it. So
you did see it.
I did see it. I saw it, right. So they just keep happening.
They just keep happening.
Until the very last moment. That's right.
Right. And that's one of the things that makes the play so interesting and exciting. And the other, of course, is, let me put it this way. I had an old football coach friend of mine say to me years ago, you can't win the ball game unless you got the horses.
To mix a metaphor.
I had the horses.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. They are unbelievable performances, every single one.
Exactly. And, you know, without that, in a three-person show, without that, you're dead.
No, you're, well, yeah.
So right. It was very carefully cast.
Where did you cast it?
I held no auditions. That's not true. I held one online. Nate came back from the National Black Theater Festival. They were there in May. And he said, I saw this guy I know could do the older man. He said, he's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I said, what's his name? He said, Torian Black. I said, Torian Black, do you know who that is? He said, no. I said, he was on Hell Street Blues for 7 years. I know exactly who you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Never auditioned him. I just said, take him.
And what, I mean, this is not we're not talking here about a young man.
No, he's 72.
And he's talking every minute.
Yes.
I mean, this is not a piece of cake to learn.
He came in without the book on the first day
You're
of rehearsal.
You're kidding.
No, on the first day of rehearsal.
Wow.
He came in without the book. Yes.
Wow. That's...
He said, you asked me to learn the lines, I learned the lines.
And
but, you know,
he did learn the lines.
At this age, you know, if I would... I've been back to acting, you know, the last couple of years. You have to really do it at this age in advance. It used to be when we were young, 20, 30 years old, we'd walk in with the book, and a week we had it learned.
Right.
You can't do it that way.
No.
You know.
Well, a lot of people can't do it at all.
Oh, I know.
You know, I mean, that is one of the things that gets more difficult, can get more difficult to do. But he's spot on, I mean, and he's, well, they're all, they are remarkable.
And then the young man that plays John, Rob Douglas, auditioned when Nate, on a, you know, the way they do it today on the computer. I mean, he just sent us a...
He sent him a YouTube kind of thing.
And Nate showed it to me, and I said, grab him.
Yeah, right.
And then, of course, Drew Foster worked for me from the time the age he was 12 to the age of 17 at the Oslo Theater.
Yeah.
As a child actor, and went on to Juilliard, and never stopped working. I mean, he was two years on the road with the West Side Story in a major role. And he was doing something, a Broadway-bound show at the Old Globe in San Diego, when I called him. And I said, Drew, how would you like to come home for Christmas, play the whipping man, with me directing at a ridiculously low salary? He said, I'm there.
Yeah. You know. And they're brilliant. You believe every minute that they are who they are.
Well, that's what Jay said in his review, every minute.
Every minute. There isn't a minute that you, and you can't take your eyes off it, you know.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. And at least some of the credit had to go to the jockey.
Oh, well, it was a wonderfully collaborative experience. It truly was. They had many of their own ideas, but they listened to me and took 90% of my direction. I mean, they were wonderful.
And you knew what you wanted once it started, right?
It's very interesting. There are some directors who have it all mapped out, literally on paper.
Yeah, I know, I've seen some of that.
They have it all mapped out. I can't do that. It's all about my hearing and my seeing. And as the moments go on, oh yeah, that's the moment. Wait a minute, go back, do it this way.
Yeah. Try that it. Works, that doesn't. Oh, that no, yeah, right. Oh, yeah, right.
And that's what leaves the actor as much of a creative force as the director is.
Right.
You know, or try another choice, make this choice. You know, the layman doesn't understand what the word choice means.
You want to say?
Yeah, sure. An actor can deliver a line meaning three or four different things in three or four different ways. That's what's meant by a choice.
Yes.
And, you know, when it works, it works. And with them, it was sheer pleasure.
That's so lovely. So lovely. Congratulations. Because, I mean, I was, like everybody else, completely blown away.
It's been a joyous experience for me. Truly a joyous experience for me. I look forward to going to rehearsal every day.
And who knows, there may be more joyous experiences like this in your, you know, I mean, because you've already paid the Directors Guild. Right.
This age of my life, it's so interesting because I can look back and I realize now that for the first 30 years, 40 years of this, it was all about my love for the theater, you know. And I've learned to balance my life out a lot more now.
Yes.
Since my retirement. And that's very nice. But I still, when I still get up to go and do it, I'll pick my projects now, you know. It's not a matter of just... Oh, yeah, I need to direct a play, you know.
No.
I don't want to do that anymore.
But I keep having this image with the metaphor, when the bell rings, you're off and running, right?
You know, if the play is right, and this play just screamed out at me. I had no plans on directing a play, West Coast. I was on the board. You know, I didn't think that was my place.
Right.
Or any of that. But I couldn't let it go. I couldn't let the play go. I couldn't let anybody else do it.
I'm sorry you can't see his face. And the passion and the delight.
It's a wonderful story. I'm glad you saw the show. Do you remember what night you saw it?
I saw it opening night.
Oh, you were there at a hell of a performance.
Oh, my God. It was mind-boggling. I mean, it was stunning, you know. And how you pronounce it Torian?
Torian.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't take my eyes off him. You know,
I know.
And he was.
I know.
But the truth is, the boys were too. They were, you know. I mean, John, they're both of them.
They were in every moment.
They were in every moment.
There was nothing outside of where they were in their world.
No, that's right.
Moment.
They were in that world.
Yeah.
That's right. And their pain.
Oh.
Each one's separate.
Yeah.
Pain.
Oh yeah.
So real, so understandable. So not their fault, you know what I mean?
And Torian's, you know, very gentle admonishment of the white man.
Well, that lovely thing at the beginning where he says, you're supposed to ask me.
Yeah.
You know.
He said, she asked me. He said, oh, my mother told you to come here. He said, no, she asked me.
That's right. And then he says, bring me the water.
I'll do that. But yeah, you knew.
That's right.
You know.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, yeah.
And he never, there was never vindicate, no. There's never vengeance in it. There's never,
no.
You know.
No.
No.
No. Oh, it's going to be like it was. It will not be like it was.
That's right.
You know, that's quiet power.
That's right. Right. To have been given to the slave in the production.
That's right. And Torian was just, well, they were all wonderful to work with, but he was, you know, he's a man that's seen it all, and he was just lovely to work with. And I couldn't get it out of my head how brilliantly this young man put, oh, last night we had such a funny incident at the talk back. The moderator, they asked the moderator about the playwright. She said, well, interestingly enough, the playwright isn't Jewish. I didn't know much about playwright. She said, his father is Puerto Rican, and his mother is Russian-Polish. I said, just a minute.
That's right.
That's a code word.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. Oh, that's great. That's right.
Code word.
Right. So he knew. He knew. Well, and whoever wrote this play.
Well, he wrote it. He knew.
He knew the
ceremony.
Everything. Right.
He knew it all.
Right.
You know, absolutely.
Right.
But what a wonderful idea he had, you know. Just the way he put the whole thing together, the slave. There's one moment in the play, if you remember, where John, the younger man, says, you know, he's read Leviticus, and the Jews are instructed very carefully about they can keep their bondsmen, but they cannot do anything to their own Israelites.
Right.
And he said, who are we?
What am I? Right.
What am I?
What am I? Am I right?
What a wonderfully complex moment in the play.
It's wonderful.
You know.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's brilliant writing.
Yeah. He's young. He's in his 30s.
Wow.
But you know, all of America's great playwrights, Arthur Miller, Tennessee Williams, O'Neill, they all wrote most productively in their 30s.
Wow.
When you think about it.
Do you have an idea about what that's about?
I don't.
Mm-hmm. It does seem somewhat paradoxical.
It does, but, that you know, Miller was like 36 or 38 when he wrote Death of a Salesman.
Right. Right.
But that's really the way my career went. Inadvertently, no plan, just looking at interesting challenges, doing it.
Well, you seemed really, for the most part, it seems to me, like you got on a track, you know, you stepped on. And it took you so much of the time.
It's interesting, if you really want to psychoanalyze it, I didn't want anybody else to be in charge of me but me.
Yes.
When you're an actor, you're at the mercy of someone sitting across the table watching you do your thing and saying, she's too short, he's too tall.
Or do it this way.
Do it, you know, it's and when you reject it, it's hard, and you have to justify that by saying, well, I'm not the type he was looking for. You never can say to yourself, I'm not talented enough.
Right.
You know, it's a hard life, an actor's life. A director's life is even more difficult because someone has to come and see your work. As an actor, you can audition. But as a director, someone has to come and see your work. If you're running something, if you're running a theater, you can hire your wife, you can hire your daughter, you can do whatever you want.
That's right. You know, this is very consistent with being the prince.
Yeah, probably so.
You know, and it has stood you in terrific stead, it seems to me.
Well, my mother drove me to success. She was relentless. But she died very young.
How old was she?
She said she was 49, but I think she was 51.
It's very young.
It's very young, yeah.
Was it very difficult for you?
Yeah. But it was very difficult. I was very close to her. As Jewish boys are with
That's
their mothers,
right.
You know. I was
That's
very
right.
close to her. And I would get very angry at her when I was growing up because she was so demanding.
Yeah.
But
she gave you all the skills that you then used in your
she
life.
She gave me survival skills.
Yes, she certainly did.
She did. She gave me survival skills.
Yeah.
And that was important.
Well, it's essential. Yeah, I'm really interested in this. I really believe that the whatever it is that you get as a, in your early life mm-hmm. will tell in your later life.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's interesting because growing up in the what I would call the Jewish ghetto in Brooklyn, I always wanted to be an American.
Yes.
Cary Grant.
Oh, God.
Little did I know he was an American. he was Jewish.
That's right.
That's besides the point. So classy. You know,
yes,
I love that.
But when I was growing up, one was still trying to assimilate.
Oh, sure.
You know, one was still trying to be an American.
Absolutely.
First. And
you're first generation?
I'm second.
You're second generation.
Yeah, my parents are first.
Yeah.
And but they had all of that, you know.
Sure.
All of that. And what it meant.
You know, my parents didn't, all they knew was they wanted me to go to college. They had no idea what that was.
Yes.
You know.
No, I remember that very well. You know, there was never any question that we would all go to college.
That's right.
That wasn't, in, you know.
That's right. That interesting enough with my sister.
Oh.
Who was, as I said, 7 years younger than me. With my sister, she was instructed or encouraged to take a commercial course and go to work and meet some nice boy and marry him.
Yeah.
Which she did.
Good girl.
And had a beautiful home on Long Island with an Olympic-sized swimming pool and three beautiful children. She was crying all the time.
Yeah.
And she went to a shrink, and they finally figured out that what she really wanted to do was go to college. She was 40 years old. And she called me up one day, she said, I'm going to college. I said, great.
God bless her.
And she went, got her master's, and was a psychologist for many, many years until she retired recently. Yeah. So my mother didn't know it, but she wound up with two college kids.
Yeah.
You know?
And somehow, even though they gave her this implicit message that she should take the commercial course, again, they gave her something that
right.
made it possible for her to do that. Lots of people don't do that.
That's right.
You know, I like to ask, having spent a life, and you really have spent a life with this work, with the work of theater, what would you say about it?
When I retired, one of the songs that was sung at my retirement party was What He Did for Love.
Oh, my.
And I cried.
Yes, I'm sure.
It's what it was always about, you know. I mean, I had to support a family, and I did enough, you know, to see to it that I could support it. But it was all about love. It was all about...
Is there anything that you would want to say about yourself, about the theater? About
If anyone could be in the place in life that I am right now, they would be extremely content.
That's very lovely. That's very
I would
lovely.
Wish on anyone the place that I am in right now. Still active and still doing what I want.
A history you're proud of and a present that you love.
A history I'm proud of, exactly. And a present that I'm absolutely relishing. So.
Mazel tov.
Thank you. Thank you. And the icing on the cake.
Mm. Well, this is wonderful. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
At 82, still doing what I love. Really, there is not a better way to describe a life spent being the person he really was. Knowing from so very young that it was the theater that drew him, knowing it so passionately, and although caring about his parents' feelings so much so that he protected them from their fear by telling them that he could teach, still following his path, his passion, his love. So, as I said, when you listen to someone like Howard, you hear a life spent following himself, knowing what it was that would make his life meaningful, that would make his life joyful. That was his life. And as he says there at the end, he did what he needed to do to live up to his responsibilities, to his parents, to a wife, to child, to his responsibilities, but at the same time, not losing sight of who he was, not at the expense of who he was. So it is my hope as I have said, that as you've listened to Howard, you have asked yourself, am I doing that? Have I been doing that? Am I living the life I was meant to live, the life that called me at some point? Did I hear a calling? Do I remember? Did I hear a calling? And then did I ignore it or deny it or tell myself that for one reason or another I couldn't have it? Well, some of the stories that you will hear on this show are of people who come around later to it. And you may be one of them. So, if you suspect that there is something that you have sacrificed, something you have left behind, and you want to try and recover it, or even just discover what it might have been, I encourage you. And again, you can get a lot of information about this on my website, thelinshow.com. And you can ask me any questions that you want. So, as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something that inspired you or intrigued you. Something you didn't know. Something you're glad you heard. Because I'd like you to come back. So I hope there was something you heard that will bring you back. And I will be here next week. Same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle.